The headlines: Iran's president slams potential backlisting of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps by the EU as a move out of desperation. Palestinians hold a funeral procession for two men killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. And French public sector workers stage nationwide strikes and rallies to protest the government's pension reform plans. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has denounced the European Parliament for making an attempt to put the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps on the EU's terror list. Raisi says the decision was made out of utter desperation. The Iranian president said the attempt is against international law and the United Nations Charter. He said the move came after the EU's efforts to hurt the Iranian nation over the recent riots. The European Parliament made the decision earlier on Thursday. The Parliament says sanctions targeting Tehran had to be expanded following the recent riots in Iran. The bill is non-binding and musters a majority of EU member states for punitive measures to counter Iran's, quote, swift backsliding in the human rights issue. Earlier, alongside author and activist Fra Hughes, we discussed the EU's duplicity and demonizing of Tehran and the IRGC while bragging about mediating talks between Iran and the West.
Well, Western governments, and I'll include America and especially Britain in this, are continually 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, trying to find ways to demonize, to isolate and to marginalize the Islamic Republic. And I think also an integral part of this is they are showing continued support for the violent protests that we have witnessed in the past in Iran. And thankfully that has been brought under control by the likes of the IRCG and other volunteer forces within Iran. These people are actually fighting terrorism inside and outside of Iran, to include the wider region. They're protecting the people of Syria, and by extension, they are protecting the people of the region. This is kind of a jingoistic politics, the politics of popularism and the politics of emotion. Let's send out a public global message to demonize the Iranian government, and by extension, the Iranian people. And I think it's very important that it's pointed out that it's illegal and non-binding, and it's just basically a wish list by the EU. I think then what they're doing is completely wrong. And the other thing that I would say on top of that is that by, you know, continuing these sanctions, on one level, they're sanctioning an official part of the Iranian government, and at the same time, Joseph Borrell is trying to claim that the EU wants to help reinvigorate and reconstitute the JCPOA. They can't be demonizing Iran on one side and then claiming to be a kind of neutral arbiter in the talks between America, I assume the UN, and Iran on Iran's nuclear program.
Dissenting views are expressed in the European Parliament regarding the EU foreign policy. While some legislators expressed support for Ukraine during the debate in the Parliament, others warned that the bloc's own citizens should not be neglected. Jerome Hughes reports.
The heads of the main EU institutions defended the 27-nation bloc's foreign policy during a debate in the European Parliament on Wednesday. They insisted that sending deadly weapons to Ukraine, costing billions of euro, is the only way to thwart Russia. Most lawmakers agree, but not all.
We see militarization, we see escalation. We are not really seeing a call for peace. We assume it will be the people who suffer the cost of sanctions.
Interest rates continue to rise in the eurozone and inflation remains extremely high. Sanctions against Moscow and the rapid move away from Russia's energy are the main reasons.
The cost of the living crisis affecting our European citizens unfortunately persists, and we are therefore concerned that the European Council conclusions fail to prioritize the support for our citizens.
Experts warn public support in the EU for the seemingly never-ending cash flow to Ukraine will eventually wane if the war persists, resulting in political consequences.
There can be a kind of danger, which is already looming, that very populistic parties, they can use this as an argument to say, look, this is something we have to cater for our own needs first, and then we have to see what's going to happen in Ukraine.
In an unprecedented departure from diplomacy on Wednesday, the European Council President Charles Michel accused authorities in Iran of operating a, quote, brutal regime. He says more sanctions against Tehran will be announced on Monday. Some lawmakers oppose the policy. By insisting that rioters in Iran are peaceful protesters, and by attempting to directly implicate the Islamic Republic in the Ukraine war, impartial analysts say the EU is being opportunistic, suggesting the new sanctions are trumped up and politically motivated. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Palestinian mourners have held a funeral for two men killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Regime troops shot to death the two Palestinians during a raid in Jenin. Violence in the West Bank has surged over the past year following stepped-up Israeli raids in Palestinian cities. The recent killings brought to 17 the number of Palestinians murdered by Israeli forces in the West Bank since January the 1st. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kendall, told us more about the latest Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp.
The Israeli forces raided the Jenin refugee camp to arrest Palestinians, and the Israeli military claimed that they wanted to arrest Khalid Abu Zainab. He is a senior member of the jihad movement, but they didn't find him at his home. They arrested his two sons during the operation to Jenin refugee camp. Of course, clashes took place between Palestinians, residents of the refugee camp, and the Israeli forces who usually use their arms during such operations. They opened fire at the protesters and killed two Palestinians, as you have mentioned. Palestinians had been warning that with the new Israeli regime led by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, there would be even more aggressive policies, more crimes would be committed against the Palestinians, not only expansion of settlements here in the occupied West Bank, annexation of land, confiscation of lands, arrest of people, killing people in cold blood.
Yemenis are calling on their government to end talks with the United Nations since the UN efforts have failed to stop the ongoing suffering of millions of Yemenis due to the Saudi-led coalition's war and blockade on Yemen. Youssef Mowry reports.
Yemenis are growing frustrated with the United Nations' failure to condemn the Saudi-led war on Yemen or to hold them responsible for the ensued disastrous ramifications. This comes just days after the UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Hans Grundberg, addressed the United Nations Security Council about the situation in Yemen. While calling for an end to violence, Grundberg declined to condemn the ongoing Saudi artillery shelling that has killed or injured dozens of civilians in the northern province of Sada.
I call on the parties to respect international humanitarian law. Military activity, combined with negative rhetoric and escalatory political and economic measures, create a situation where a simple miscalculation could reignite a cycle of violence that will be difficult.
Grundberg also called for humanitarian aid to Yemen, but mentioned nothing about the lifting of the Saudi blockade, which is the main obstacle preventing vital aid and food supplies from entering the country. This military general we spoke with on the streets of the Yemeni capital says the United Nations is the root cause of all evil in Yemen.
The UN destroys every country they get involved in. Look at what they did in Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Sudan. As for Yemen, the United Nations and all of its envoys' efforts in Yemen have been directed at spying on Yemenis, instigating conflicts among Yemenis and fueling chaos and instability.
Some Yemenis are calling on their government to abandon all political talks with the UN. They accused the UN of complicity with the Saudi-led coalition in the killing of Yemenis. The Yemeni government has stated that if the blockade is not lifted and salaries are not paid, the only option left is war. The Yemeni people and government have expressed that the 8-year Saudi-imposed siege on Yemen must be broken by any means necessary. This after years of failed political efforts to resolve the conflict by the United Nations, an entity which most Yemenis lost trust in and accuse of supporting the Saudi military aggression on Yemen. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
And France public sector workers are holding nationwide strikes in opposition to the planned position reform by the government of President Emmanuel Macron. Workers from multiple sectors, including transport, education, and energy, have joined the industrial action. Transport minister has warned of, quote, hellish Thursday for commuters, urging all those who can to work from home. Meanwhile, the interior minister reported the deployment of thousands of police force to maintain calm. Union leaders call it the first day of mobilization and their struggle to get the pension plan dropped. The main CGT union has even threatened to cut off electricity supplies to lawmakers and billionaires. They are against the proposal to raise the minimum retirement age to 64, as well as contributions to receive full pensions. The reform still needs to go through Parliament, where Macron lacks the absolute majority, but hopes to get it adopted with the support of conservatives. Journalist and political analyst Gerard Coleman earlier joined us with his take on the nationwide strikes in France and the possible outcome.
This is really about sort of curbing social benefits for workers in France, and it's about sort of rolling back the fairly advanced social system that was built up in France after the Second World War, which enabled people to get pensions and to have holiday pay and so on. This is only being supported really by the syndicate of the ruling elite, that is to say MEDEF, which is the syndicate of the wealthiest people in France. They are in favor of this reform, but pretty much all the parties from the far left, the so-called far left to the far right, are against this reform. So it is an extremely unpopular reform. Right now in Paris, about 12 metro stations are closed. So the metro train system has been paralyzed. The national education system has also had a lot of blockages. And the electricity system as well is very much perturbed by this. So it's quite a significant mobilization. The question is, will it lead to anything? I don't think it will, because these kind of mobilizations in the past have never really succeeded in stopping Emmanuel Macron.
Russia's foreign minister has reiterated Moscow's readiness to discuss the war in Ukraine with Western countries. Sergei Lavrov, however, says Russia has yet to see any serious proposals for peace. He said peace talks need to address Russia's security concerns. Lavrov made those remarks in a press conference in Moscow. He said Washington has subjugated Europe to its dictatorship in order to wage a war against Moscow.
Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov has held a press briefing to give an update on the ongoing war in Ukraine. In his press briefing, which was held in Moscow on Wednesday, Lavrov accused Ukraine's foreign policy of being under the dictation of Western nations. The Russian top diplomat further noted that Western nations have yet to make, quote, serious proposals to Russia on how the conflict should be resolved. Lavrov added that Russia was willing to support a draft truce proposed by Ukraine in late March, but the proposal was destroyed by Ukraine's Western supporters. He also said, in reality, the West decides for Ukraine what its foreign policy should be. Western officials have repeatedly claimed that arming Ukraine would help it achieve a better negotiation position and that no talks with Russia should take place before this happens. Lavrov further said Moscow would react to any serious proposal for overcoming the crisis that come from the US and its allies, but none has been sent so far. He also added that the West is using Ukraine to destroy the security system that existed in Euro-Atlantic for many years.
Thousands of people in Catalonia have protested against a summit between Spain and France in Barcelona calling for the independence of Catalan regions in both countries. Protesters waved pro-independence flags and held signs that read neither Spain nor France. They chanted separatist slogans ahead of the arrival of the Spanish minister Pedro Sanchez and the French president Emmanuel Macron. Catalonia launched a failed independence bid in 2017. The Spanish leader of the separatist movement is in self-imposed exile in Belgium to avoid prosecution back home. Peruvian police have clashed with anti-government protesters in the country's south, leaving one of them dead. The death brings to 43 the number of people killed in clashes between protesters and security forces since the unrest gripped the South American nation in December. Meanwhile, thousands of people have converged on the capital, Lima, to vent their anger at the government of President Dina Boluarte. Peru's General Confederation of Workers has also called for a strike on Thursday. Protesters are demanding the resignation of the president, early elections, and a new constitution. Boluarte assumed office days after former President Pedro Castillo was removed from office and detained over his alleged attempt to dissolve Congress in order to avoid impeachment. Castillo's supporters are calling for his release.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Scientists are once again warned that by 2030, the emission of greenhouse gases should be reduced by half around the world in order to avoid the worst of climate change. They say the moving countries on the current dangerous path will add another 3 degrees Celsius to the current level of global warming, which is twice more than the threshold of 1.5 degrees Celsius that was set at the COP21 Paris Climate Summit. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Scientists have warned the return of El Niño climate phenomena later this year will cause global temperatures to rise off the chart and deliver unprecedented heat waves. Early forecasts suggest El Niño will return later in 2023, exacerbating extreme weather around the globe and making it very likely the world would exceed 1.5 degrees Celsius of global warming. The hottest year in recorded history, 2016, was driven by a major El Niño. It is part of a natural oscillation driven by ocean temperatures and winds in the Pacific Ocean, which switches between El Niño, its cooler counterpart La Niña, and neutral conditions. The last 3 years have seen an unusual run of consecutive La Niña events. This year is already forecast to be hotter than 2022, which global data sets rank as the 5th or 6th hottest year on record. But El Niño occurs during the Northern Hemisphere winter, and its heating effect takes months to be felt, meaning 2024 is much more likely to set a new global temperature record. The greenhouse gases emitted by human activities have driven up average global temperatures by about 1.2 degrees Celsius to date. This has already led to catastrophic impacts around the world, from searing heat waves in the United States and Europe to devastating floods in Pakistan and Nigeria, harming millions of people. Professor Adam Scaife, the head of long-range prediction at the UK Met Office, said the fluctuating impacts of the El Niño and La Niña cycle would be seen in many regions of the world. Professor Scaife added, "Science can now tell us when these things are coming months ahead, so we really do need to use it and be more prepared, from having readiness of emergency services right down to what crops to plant." While El Niño would supercharge extreme weather, the degree of exacerbation was under debate among scientists. Professor Bill Maguire of University College London said, "When El Niño arrives, the extreme weather that has rampaged across our planet in 2021 and 2022 will pale into insignificance." While Professor Tim Palmer of University of Oxford said, "The correlation between extreme weather and global mean temperatures is not that strong, but the thermodynamic effects of climate change are going to make the anomalies we get from an El Niño year just that much more extreme." Climate modelling results issued in early January by Australia's Bureau of Meteorology indicated the country could swing from 3 years of above-average rainfall to one of the hottest, driest El Niño periods on record, increasing the risk of severe heat waves, droughts and wildfires. In December, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the NOAA, rated the odds of an El Niño forming by August to October as 66%. Turkey's Anadolu News Agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Britain's Meteorological Office has forecast this year will be warmer than last year and one of the hottest on record. Predictions suggest it will be the 10th year in a row the global temperature is at least 1 degree Celsius above average. Scientific evidence shows that climate change is driving up global temperatures. In July, the United Kingdom recorded its hottest temperature ever, with the mercury hitting 40.2 degrees Celsius, that is 104.3 degrees Fahrenheit, at Heathrow Airport in West London. The heat wave also sparked bushfires in and around London, setting houses ablaze. Some countries across Europe had been struggling to put out wildfires and at times have been criticised by activists for not doing enough to combat the climate crisis and its effects. Although the general take is that the world is heading towards a warmer year, scientists are professionally cautious when asked how the coming summer will be. Meteorologist Andy Hill told Anadolu News Agency that it is not possible to give a confident forecast, but also cited a report by the American Meteorological Society, which points to changes in the monthly average to understand that 2023 will see the world entering an El Niño, a periodic event that involves above-average sea surface temperatures across East and Central Equatorial Pacific Ocean. The Met Office's Nick Dunstan, who has led the 2023 global temperature forecast, said, "The global temperature over the last 3 years has been influenced by the effect of a prolonged La Niña, where cooler than average sea surface temperatures occur in the tropical Pacific Ocean." Nick Dunstan added, "For the next year, our climate model is indicating an end to the 3 consecutive years with a La Niña state and a return to relatively warmer conditions in parts of the tropical Pacific Ocean. This shift is likely to lead to global temperatures in 2023 being warmer than 2022. Maximiliano Herrera, a meteorologist who focuses on climate data, agreed that the probability of warmer than average conditions occurring is greater for cooler conditions. According to data collected by Herrera, just this month, the warmest January day ever was recorded in at least 8 European countries, including Poland, Denmark, the Czech Republic, Netherlands, Belarus, Lithuania, and Latvia. The website of Business Insider India writes, "If you ever shared a common working space with someone, you know there's at least a 10-degree difference between setting the AC at 21 degrees C and 24 degrees C, even if science can't prove it. However, the effects of such excruciating yet minuscule change disappear once you leave the room, something that unfortunately cannot be said for global rising temperatures. What's worse is that the sheer scale of damage the global warming can inflict is incomparable for even the tiniest temperature increments. We stand to lose entire countries to sea level rise and immeasurable species to habitat destruction, with billions more getting exposed to tragedy if the 1.5 degrees Celsius Paris warning target is breached." And a new UK Met study shows that the spiral may begin from just next year. If you aren't familiar with El Niño and La Niña, they're basically extremely large-scale weather patterns in the Pacific Ocean that can disrupt worldwide weather and even affect marine life to a considerable extent. Both affect west-blowing trade winds along the equator, which help in moving warmer water from South America towards Asia. And the effect and position of this warm water butterflies into creating distinct weather phenomena all over the world. We've been experiencing La Niña conditions for the past 3 years, something that is due to change very, very soon. And this is concerning because La Niñas are generally associated with a temporary cooling effect on temperatures. That's right, the last 3 years were supposed to be among the cool ones. Thank you, global warming. Once the weather patterns oscillate back to El Niño, that is associated with warmer weather patterns, you best believe that sweater days might have to take a temporary back seat in some parts of the world over the next few years. For reference, El Niño year of 2016 was the hottest year on record since 1850, and also the year where the Great Barrier Reef faced the largest die-off event, again fueled by El Niño.
Hidden Files.
That's right, 40 acres and a mule. After 246 years of slavery, that is what African Americans who had been enslaved were promised by the U.S. government. Well, that was back in 1865, and although that was no real compensation for 2.5 centuries of slavery, even that promise was not kept towards Black Americans. It became symbolic of all the other promises, laws, programs that were supposed to bring about more economic parity with whites for Black Americans, but never took place. Hello, and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Today, we're going to take you on a journey that started centuries ago on the African continent and yet still has proportional consequences on millions of African Americans today. Estimates vary from $6 trillion to $60 trillion, the value of those 40 acres and a mule today. Well, the wealth never paid to the former slaves nor their descendants. The generational wealth that was never passed down, that opportunity, like so many others, that was never provided to blacks, while endless opportunities, grants, raises, stipends, etc., were given to white Americans. The results show a staggering difference between black and white wealth, even in America today.
In 2019, the median white household was worth $188,200. The median black household held $24,100 in wealth. White households had 7.8 times more wealth than blacks. In 2020, whites made up 60% of the U.S. population, but held 84% of the total household wealth. Black households, who constituted 13.4% of the U.S. population, held 4% of the total household wealth. White households inherit over 5.3 times more than black households. And white households are 2.8 times more likely than black households to inherit any wealth.
Well, we're going to dig into this issue further with our first guest, Cam Howard.
Cam Howard is a reparations expert who has been fighting for decades to get reparations for black Americans. He has addressed the United Nations and has traveled the world presenting the case for reparations for African Americans. He is an administrator for NCOBRA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America.
Thanks so much for being with us. Do you think that black Americans should get reparations, and if so, why?
So I certainly believe that blacks in this country should get reparations. And it's primarily because of, you know, two reasons. One, there's never been justice and fairness in any large measure for African-Americans, people of African descent in this country. As you know, we came here as stolen, kidnapped people from the continent of Africa to slave in the cotton fields and tobacco fields and rice fields. In America, and then later in some of the factories during the industrial age, the tremendous amount of crimes were committed against us during the period of enslavement. But then after the period of enslavement, we had a brief period called Reconstruction in this country where there was some semblance of fairness and justice. Then that was followed by another 80 plus years of terroristic apartheid by white supremacist organizations in this country that removed, again, all notions of fairness and justice in the areas of education, in areas of economics, in the area of labor, employment, et cetera. There was criminal punishment, criminal justice. There's been no fairness. There was no fairness. It was an apartheid system backed by the terror of the state. And then after the Jim Crow period, apartheid period in this country in 1965 and their 60s, as a result of the civil rights movement, we had a small window of fairness and justice with the Civil Rights Act, the Fair Housing Act, and the Voting Rights Act that was passed. And then in the 70s, we had a semblance of fairness with affirmative action. But all those things have been stripped down, taken away the teeth of what should have been given to us in the area of fairness and justice. They've been watered down. So when you look at the police violence in our communities, it's still a continuation of the non-fair and non-just treatment that we receive in this country. So, you know, only a brief, very brief periods in this country of African Americans ever received the type of fair and just treatment that immigrants and people who are, you know, other Americans or people who just come to America, they receive just by being within these boundaries. But African Americans as a whole, we have not shared any type of governmental fairness and justice for the long haul. Secondly, reparations are due because of the tremendous injury that we still suffer from today as a result of these hundreds of years, centuries of mistreatment in this country. When you look at every area of people of activity in this country, Blacks on the bottom of every good list, on the top of every bad list, whether it's education, whether it's housing, whether it's criminal punishment, whether it's wealth, whether it's, you know, health, maternal mortality, infant mortality, all these things, you see a stark difference between Black lived experience and white lived experience in this country.
Well, what type of reparations are you proposing?
We look at reparations in the forms of, from the international law standpoint, of gross crimes committed by a state against the civilian population, where that tends to lay out what is known as full reparation. And there's five basic components. First component is cessation and guarantees of non-repetition. First, you must stop the bad acts. You must eliminate the public policy that disproportionately negatively affect people of African descent in this country. That's first and foremost. The criminal justice laws, the housing laws, the economic laws that exist, the disproportionate resource allocation toward education and other aspects of our community. First, you must cease those policies and then put in place structures that ensure that those policies don't show up again. Like when enslavement ended, enslavement resurfaced for another 45 years in the form of convict leasing, in the form of sharecropping, in the form of debt peonage, where, you know, that we still existed in enslavement, but it was not called enslavement. So we need to stop these bad policies that exist today and make sure that we put in structures that they don't resurface. The second component of full reparations is restitution. How do you return the people back to where they would have been had these crimes not committed? So we're talking centuries of crime. So there's going to be multiple generations of repair that's necessary in the areas of education, in the areas of economic development and wealth building and employment and these type of areas and land acquisition and housing. All these areas have to be addressed and redressed with targeted resources. The third component is compensation. When restitution doesn't alleviate a situation, the compensation is an obligatory form of reparations under international norms. And we certainly know that in order for us to have some type of parity and wealth in this country, there's going to have to be some type of direct compensation. We don't know what that be and how much it would be, but certainly we are fighting for that because it is, again, obligatory under international law to redress the situation in its entirety. The fourth component of full reparations is satisfaction. How do you return a dignity back to a people whose dignity was eroded as a result of the crimes you committed against them? Sometimes an apology will do that. Other times, you know, museums, markers, removing a statuary, creating monuments, new monuments, curriculum overhaul, truth and reconciliation commissions, those type of things lend to dignity, return, or satisfaction. And then the fifth component is rehabilitation for the mind, heart, and spirit damage to the people as a result of their crimes. Black people in America have the worst health profile among any people. Our health profile is similar to those in quote-unquote third world countries in certain areas. Highest rates of cancer, highest rate of heart attack, highest rates of infant mortality, maternal mortality, as I stated, highest rates of breast cancers among women, the highest rates of testicular cancer or prostate cancer among men. I mean, the health profile is terrible. And we know now through transgeneration epigenetic inheritance that that health profile is a result of the historical trauma we've experienced as a people in this country.
Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Mr. Cam Howard. We're going to take a look at a few instances that have taken a place over the years and why African Americans are demanding reparations. You know, slavery launched modern capitalism and actually turned the United States into the wealthiest country in the world. Looking at this cotton production, I mean, by the 1830s, 77% of U.S. cotton was used for the British textile industry. And look at that, 2.25 billion pounds of cotton in 1859. And you know, the cotton actually built New York City as a commercial and financial center. And if you look at the whole worth after the outbreak of the Civil War and the values of slaves, $3 billion, 48% of total wealth in the South in 1860. So very valuable commodity. The emancipation, though, of African Americans did not bring about any type of economic freedom. There were continual policies to make sure that they never got their rights, starting off, of course, with not getting the 40 acres and a mule. However, the slave owners in the South, they actually got compensation after the Civil War, $300 per slave loss or freed. And throughout the time, the safety nets for other Americans was never in place for African Americans, not the loans, not the access to affordable housing in good neighborhoods. There was redlining to prevent them. And even when they could take off a little and be successful in some type of business, as we see like Black Wall Street, then there were efforts to totally eliminate and annihilate any type of success that they had. I mean, this is just a very, very small example of some of the reasons why African Americans are demanding reparations.
Kalonji Jamachanga currently serves as co-chair of the Urban Survival and Preparedness Institute and is co-founder of Black Power Media. He has fought on multiple fronts, tackling issues from local and national police brutality cases to international human rights violations. Under Kalonji's direction, as founder and national coordinator of the FTP movement, programs such as International Feed the People and the National Coalition to Combat Police Terrorism have matured and developed. He has shared his experiences in the best-selling book, How to Build a People's Army, and the documentary, Organizing is the New Cool.
Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Mr. Kalonji Jamachanga. What's your perspective in general regarding reparations?
You know, when I think of reparations, you know, most people think reparations as money. That's not what we're talking about. Our first order of operation is our political prisoners, because like any other civilized nation, whenever there is war or there's any type of, you know, fighting or what have you, any type of disagreements, the first thing before anything can go down is they want their captives back. You know what I mean? So we want our political prisoners back first and foremost. And it is my belief that the question around reparations should also include the continent. the continent of Africa. I think that, the first thing should be, they should be paying reparations to folks on the continent because they stole not only the land, not only the minerals and you know, the wealth, they stole us, they stole humans, you know? So, we totally believe that reparations should be paid, but will it be paid? We don't believe this country is capable of that type of accountability or respect for us as a whole.
What type of reparations in general do you think would be necessary?
You know, land is definitely, you know, is necessary. You know, we're not just talking about some cash, because we know that the U.S. dollar doesn't mean anything. And we know that if they gave us reparations with cash, then they'll just raise the prices up. They'll hike the prices up. You know, so, you know, that's a foolish notion that all we want is money. You know, we know that the American dollar has no real value across the globe. They place their own value on it. You know, so we don't want anything that they can take away. What we'd really like you said, is to be left alone. What we really like is to folks to say, you know what, we want to return these goods. We want to make good with our people. But we know that under a capitalist society, we know that capitalism is a violent system. You cannot have capitalism without the pain and suffering of others. They package it well. They make you feel comfortable, make you feel like, you know, yes, you should be a part of the capitalist system and you should grow and, you know, everything's going to be all right. But it's not the case. They let a few, quote unquote, African-Americans and a few so-called minorities, or should we say other oppressed people, give them the illusion of power. And, you know, power is about self-determination. So if you don't have self-determination and you don't have a place of your own and you don't have your own tongue and your own culture, then again, you are a displaced person. You are a person that's running around trying to find themselves. And that is how they have us right now. So we're talking about 500 years of this practice of terrorism. So we must understand that, unfortunately, in this country in particular, when you are, their success has to equal your failure. Someone has to be at the bottom and someone has to be at the top. And in the capitalist system, the folks at the bottom will always get stepped on in order to benefit those who are at the top, the oppressors.
In your perspective, what are some of the systemic efforts that have taken place in order to prevent African Americans from achieving equality?
The whole notion of equality is a myth, because we were brought here as chattel slaves, as surplus labor. We were brought here as, and treated like domesticated animals, you know. So they looked at us as property. They never looked at us as equal, you know. Even on paper, they said we were 3/5 of human beings. They didn't even consider us a human being. Matter of fact, the quote unquote forefathers of this country, they treated us like objects. You know, even when you talk about folks like George Washington, these are, you know, most of the men who happen to be on the money here, the dollar bills and the cash and the coins, these are former slave masters. You know, these are folks who gave away Africans, and we don't consider ourselves slaves. We were enslaved, because we weren't slaves when we encountered these folks. So we were enslaved Africans. So these are folks who literally gave us away. George Washington's wife gave Africans away for wedding gifts. They gave us away like we were poodles, or like we were some type of plants, or some type of exotic horse. You know what I'm saying? Like we were camels. We were treated as nothing more than you know, like I said, domesticated animals. Like we were tricks. We performed for these people. We worked for these people. We built for these people. And in turn, we were enslaved, we were tortured, and to this very day, we are victims of a systematic oppression, which, again, stems from capitalism and global white supremacy. This is what it's all about. You know, capitalism and enslavement are Siamese twins.
We're just about out of time, Mr. Changa, but do you have any final thoughts?
I would like to say that people of the world, oppressed people, quote-unquote third world people, we have to resist imperialism at every turn. We have to, you know, like it says in Islam, we have to change things with our hands. And if we can't change it with our hands, we have to speak out against it. And if we don't speak out against it, then we at least have to hate it in our hearts. We have to remember that we are here for a limited time, and we have the right to exist. We have the right to love. We have the right to be our natural selves. And no man, woman, or child should be able to exploit, dominate, or oppress us.
Very powerful words. Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files. From 1619, when the first Africans were enslaved in what would become the United States, until the present, Africans and their descendants in that country have never been considered as equals with their white counterparts. They have been the victims of systemic terrorism as they have built that country, and now they are demanding their fair share of it. Will they get reparations? Will their demands be met? Not likely, but we will continue to follow their story, their cases, and their demands for justice. And we'll bring you all the latest on that right here at Hidden Files. And make sure you join me and the team right here next week as we dig into another Hidden File. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.